Five, four, three, two, one. Yeehaw, and we're live. My good friend Doug Duran. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Joe Rogan.
Good to see you as always.
Oh, man. It is
and,
good to be here.
And Brian Richards, your friend, wildlife biologist. And, well, we're going to talk about a bunch of things, but one of the things that I wanted to talk about is this scary disease that, well, when Ted Nugent was on the podcast, he downplayed the consequences and effects of something called CWD, or chronic wasting disease, which has made it onto your farm. And you live in Wisconsin, and you have this beautiful place that we visited when we did the Meat Eater television show. And this is a new thing, that this chronic wasting disease, which decimates the deer's health and kills them. And the suspicion is that some of this, at least, comes from these high fence operations where people grow deer and treat them like, instead of like a wild animal, they treat them like a domesticated animal and have them all feeding off of the same pile of food, and they share this disease. Is this all correct and accurate, Brian?
Boy, you just started out about an hour's worth of conversation. So, yeah, just a little bit. I'm a wildlife biologist with the National Wildlife Health Center, U.S. Geological Survey, up in Madison, Wisconsin. And so one of the things that I spend a lot of time on is chronic wasting disease. I wouldn't say that makes me necessarily an expert, but I've gotten to know a lot of people that I would call experts over the years. So I've gained a little bit of knowledge. So I don't even – your statement there, we could start a number of different places.
Yeah. This disease, it essentially – describe what it does to these animals and why it's such a major concern. It hasn't jumped to humans yet.
That we're aware of.
But it is a possibility, a very real possibility.
We can't rule it out at this point in time. Science is unable to rule it out. So, okay, that's a great place to start. Why would we care about this thing called chronic wasting disease? And I would argue, and some other scientists have argued, there's two major reasons. Number one is the impacts of this disease on members of the deer family themselves. And the other is that we cannot rule out the possibility that CWD could become a human health issue at some point down the road. Okay, so you kind of nailed those two. With regard to deer, or members of the deer family, white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, moose, and most recently it was picked up in reindeer in Norway, of all places, we could articulate some reasons, some rationale why this disease might be thought of as being important. The first we'd look at would be geographic spread. So, CWD 20 years ago was thought to be this really novel thing in a very restricted geographic range in southeastern Wyoming, adjacent north eastern Colorado, and maybe a little spillover into Nebraska. Wildlife biologists, wildlife disease specialists looked at this disease. It was interesting. We didn't know much about it at that point in time, but it seemed to be very isolated there.
What does it do to the deer?
It kills deer.
Okay? Right, but how does it kill them?
All right, so this is a member of a family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or TSEs. So big, long words. Transmissible means it can go from animal A to animal B. Spongiform means looks like a sponge, and encephalopathy means disease of the brain. So you put it together, and so this disease results in holes in the brain, resulting in progressive neurological degeneration followed by death. Okay? It's a death sentence.
And there's no cure for it? It's not like you can capture the deer and give them some sort of medication?
No cure for these diseases. The suite of diseases, members of this TSE group of diseases in humans. Most familiar is one called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Right. So it's very similar to mad cow disease.
They're in the same family.
So that's it comes one from that's prions?
I'd say prions. You could say prions.
Sorry. I don't know how to say it. Read it.
That's an interesting, there's a it goes back and forth on whether it's prion or prion. Stan Preusner, who received a Nobel laureate for his work on these diseases, coined the term prion. Mm-hmm. And in his first publication describing these diseases, he did a phonetic spelling, and it's prion. So other researchers, especially some from across the pond, say it's got to be prion. And the main reason that, you know, some of them I've talked to about that is that it irks Stan Preusner when he hears it called prion.
Oh, so we'll say prion.
Yeah.
So I'll say prion from now on. Now, this disease, which people know as mad cow disease, obviously is transmissible to humans. And that's one of the reasons why people are very scared that this could potentially jump from deer into humans. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it also is making its way into the actual plants that these animals eat.
You're correct on both accounts. So with BSE, mad cow disease, that was an interesting disease where it resulted from, in essence, turning cows into cannibals. We were
which
recycling.
Also exists in New Guinea, right, with cannibals, Jacob Creutzfeldt.
With kuru, which is a human disease, a TSE, likely started when one individual developed Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. That individual died. And as is the practice, was the practice in the Foray tribe in Papua New Guinea, they practiced ritualized cannibalism to honor the dead and to help release the spirits from, you know, deceased family members. So they would feed upon the corpse and pour, you know, the bodies of their deceased. So when one individual died of probably some variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, then the causative agent, the prion protein, which is concentrated in the central nervous system and lymphatic systems of, you know, of diseased patients, this was fed back to other members of the family and the extended family. And so when they got sick and died, fed it again. So we saw that with kuru in 1960 or around there. It was realized that this cannibalistic behavior was likely the result, you know, or likely the cause of disease transmission. Cannibalism was outlawed. And at that point in time, you broke completely the disease transmission cycle. So no more new cases of kuru. But they had lingering cases with an extended incubation period up to 40 years later before kuru finally burned out of that population.
Huh. Whoa.
So now with BSE, or mad cow disease, we were doing exactly, in essence, the same thing. Not exactly the same thing, but in essence. So in an effort to maximize production and reduce the amount of waste, when they butchered cattle, we would take all the offal, O-F-F-A-L, you know, the hide, the bones, the parts that are inedible. And we would render them, cook them at high temperature and typically, you know, high pressure as well. And it turns into a slurry, a high-protein slurry. You skim the fat off the top of that and then dehydrate the rest of it, and you have, you know, kind of a meat and bone meal, a high-protein supplement, realizing that cattle grow faster and produce better when on a higher protein diet. It seemed reasonable to use waste material from cows to feed back to cows.
Oof.
So at some point, turning
it doesn't get better, Joe.
Turning cows into cannibals.
Yeah.
So at some point in time, a cow developed a TSE, a prion disease. Whether it came from scrapie, the TSE of sheep, or arose on its own is unknown. But that cow died. It was rendered into meat and bone meal, and this high-protein feed was then fed out to hundreds to thousands.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but these prions, they could survive up to more than 1,000 degree temperature.
Yeah, surviving is kind of a strange term, Joe, in that they're not alive to start with. It's a protein. They can persist. They cannot be inactivated. So, yeah, you'd have to cook pretty hot.
These prions are not necessarily a living thing like a disease or a virus or a bacteria.
Well, they're a disease-causing agent, but they are incredibly unique. So they're an etiologic agent, like a virus, a bacteria, or, you know, a parasite could be causing disease. But all these other things have genetic material. They're alive, which allows them to change rapidly to evolve over time. So the whole concept that you have a protein that all mammals produce in a normal form, can be converted after production into a disease-associated form that has these radically different characteristics. One that you mentioned was, you know, resistance to heat treatment. A normal prion protein, and we have billions of them circulating in our bodies right now, have a specific purpose, a cellular purpose. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's likely involved in some sort of intracellular communication. It's a string of around 250 amino acids So a relatively short protein. It does whatever it does, and then the body recycles, breaks that chain of amino acids down into its component parts and recycles it. Turns out that normal cellular prion protein likely has a half-life of maybe 4 to 6 hours. Okay, so you're producing them relatively constantly. Then there's the disease-associated form, and all disease-associated prions start as the normal cellular prion. So they're converted from one three-dimensional form to a different form, okay? And this different form has these radically different characteristics. One is heat resistance. Another is UV light resistance. I mentioned that the normal cellular prion protein has a half-life of maybe 4 to 6 hours. The disease-associated ones can persist in the environment for years and potentially up to decades. Okay?
And when you say persist in the environment, you mean in like on the ground, on leaves, on like how would they persist?
Yeah, all of those things, Joe. So if a deer sheds infectious agent, this prion protein, and so you know, from the time a deer is infected, it's probably around 2 years before it develops clinical signs of disease, goes downhill, loses its fear of humans, dramatic weight loss, all of those things. That incubation period, you know, it's probably shedding infectious agent for the vast majority of that time period. So it looks healthy, but it's able of transmitting disease. We'd call that, you know, a typhoid Mary syndrome.
The two deer that we that were positive on our farm, two and a half year old bucks, we had them tested. As you know, we're for the last several years we've been getting. Initially, we got our only bucks tested, and then the last 3 or 4 years we've gotten all the deer tested. They were 2.5 year old bucks. Looked perfectly healthy.
And these are the first ones that you tested
that tested positive? When we tested in excess of 35 deer over the last, more than that, probably
now,
more like 50.
During the incubation period, would they still test positive?
At some point they will.
At some point. So they could be spreading infectious agents without testing positive?
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
Fuck.
So it's probably between 3 and 6 months out when we can test an animal test positive. But it's likely shedding infectious agent, at least at lower quantities, prior to that point in time. And so it's shedding infectious agent. It's capable of transmitting disease, okay, long before it looks clinically ill. And so that's one of the real challenges with this disease from a management standpoint. They look perfectly healthy. They act perfectly healthy. But they're starting to have that progressive neurological degeneration that we can only see very near the end of disease.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems like we could potentially be facing a ticking time bomb of many, many, many deer that are wandering around out there right now that look totally normal, that are spreading this stuff all over the place, and they're acting normal, they look perfectly healthy. And then, obviously, with this multi-year incubation period, this could just cascade.
And I think we've seen evidence of that now. Started out, you know, we talked about being isolated disease. It was picked up in Wisconsin at the end of 2001. As of today, CWD has now been picked up in 25 states in captive and or free-ranging populations in white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, or moose, two Canadian provinces. In addition, it was picked up in South Korea, and that was real interesting. It was in captive elk. And those elk still had Canadian ear tags in them. So we pretty much know how CWD, you know, those elk didn't swim across the Pacific pond. Most recently, it was picked up 2 years ago in free-ranging reindeer in Norway. And subsequent to that, it was picked up in a small handful, like 3 or 4 moose and a red deer in Norway and a single moose in Finland. It's a real concern over in Norway. With reindeer. Okay, so reindeer are very gregarious. You know, white-tailed deer.
Caribou, same.
You know, caribou reindeer. So not unusual to see them in herds of hundreds of animals. So very, very different than what we see with white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, or moose. We don't see those huge herds. Well, with elk you can in the wintertime. But anyway, it's thought that this gregarious behavior might really facilitate transmission in reindeer. Right? So when it was picked up in reindeer, Norway said, you know, maybe we should do something. It's an interesting story in that You know, Norway's got experience with scrapie and sheep. And so they have a long history.
What is scrapie?
Scrapie is the same as, well, it's the same family of diseases in sheep. It's actually the first one that was described, scrapie, we've known about since the early 1700s. A disease of domestic sheep, and it's called scrapie because of the behavior these animals, once they enter the clinical phase of disease, display. And they seem like they itch bad. And so they'll go up to fence posts and other objects, and they'll literally rub their hide off of their body. So that's the name scrapie. And it's the same progressive neurological disorder followed by death. And you think about it. So as this disease creates vacuoles in the brain, it's killing off neurons. And so without those neurons firing, you fall into that progressive degeneration. And yet at some point, your body can no longer survive. And that's what's really spooky about how this thing kills. So anyway, go back to Norway. When they detected CWD...
Brian, try to keep this a little bit closer to you. Sorry, you're very soft-spoken.
Oh, no worries. I can hear myself plenty.
I know. It's just that the problem is the recording. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay, no worries. So when they picked up CWD in reindeer in Norway... the researchers over there had witnessed what we, our lack of success on this side of the pond over the course of the last 20 years. They took it very, very seriously. So they took kind of some harsh medicine. They announced their plans that they were going to eliminate a herd unit. They were going to kill every reindeer in an entire herd unit in Norway. The idea is to eliminate the host population. It's called stamping out, and it works in a pen. This is the first time it'd been done realistically in a free-ranging population. The whole idea is we don't have effective tools for management of disease. They were very fearful of what would happen if this spread throughout that reindeer population and throughout other reindeer herds.
And like Alaska, they have multiple herds. Like last year, I hunted caribou with Steve up in the 40-mile River area. But there were, you know, and so they're very well localized is probably not, but at least they have a range that they move through. So, and in Norway they have two or three different herds.
Many more than that. So I don't know exactly how many herd units they have.
But the point was that you could isolate one of the herds.
So the idea is before this gets be any worse, before it gets any farther, let's take it out. So they had a hunting season. They allowed hunters to take as many as they could, which was a little over 1,000 reindeer. Then they came in with government agents.
But isn't there a concern that the hunters could eat something with CWD and then catch it?
Well, that's always a concern. But we can talk about human health. Let me finish this with Norway. In that, so they literally took the bull by the horns. They decided to do what was very unpopular, what we have not been able to do in North America. So after the hunting season, government agents, sharpshooters, took an additional 1,400 reindeer. So they killed every reindeer in this herd unit, and they're going to keep it fallow, allow no reindeer in there for a minimum of 5 years. So this has every bit of promise of being the first large-scale success with dealing with this disease in a free-ranging herd. Pretty different than what we've been able to accomplish over here.
5 years, is that, with it being in the soil and dirt and it, from what I was reading, wood and everything else, is that so at some point there becomes the prions diminish in population or they die out or whatever the proper word. I mean, they're not living, so they don't die, but five they don't become years, viable anymore?
Yeah, 5 years is probably a pretty good – it's a guesstimate, okay, with regard to how long these prions remain viable in the environment and in the substrate. So it's a good first guess. And what they'll do then is slowly allow reindeer to repopulate. And as they do, they'll be harvested periodically, and every one of those will be tested. So, I mean, it'll be a long-term experiment into, you know, successful management, and it will also learn quite a bit about whether how far along the environment was contaminated. So another thing, they caught this disease very early. So after killing off, you know, 2,400 reindeer, I think they had around 20 positives. So very low prevalence, suggesting the disease was very, very new in this system. So if you're going to be successful with a disease where animals are shedding infectious agent out into the environment, it persists for years to decades, do it early. You know, if you're going to get on it, detect it early, get on it fast, get on it hard.
Why the decision to let human beings consume them?
Well, at this point in time, we really don't have any evidence that humans can get CWD.
Could that potentially, though, be an incubation period issue, just like it is with deer, maybe extended with humans? Because you were talking about it was the correct pronunciation. I was pronouncing it wrong.
Kuru.
No. Jakob Creutzfeldt.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob's
disease. So that has a long incubation period in human beings, correct?
Likely, yeah.
And mad cow, same thing.
Extended incubation period. Kuru could, some of the cases, it looks like we're up maybe even to 40, maybe even 50-year incubation period in individuals.
That is crazy.
I want to talk about Kuru for a minute, because every time I talk to this guy, I mean, I've learned a lot from him about all kinds of things and diseases, but yesterday we were talking about Kuru, and one of the things that was interesting to me about it is that these tribes, the women and children contracted it first.
Isn't that interesting?
And the reason why was the men ate the meat, and the women and children ate the
internal organs
and brain.
Yeah, so
concentrated.
Yeah, as Kuru took off, it was one of the features as the researchers in the in the 50s and 1950s were looking at the population. Very few adult males had Kuru. And it was more focused in the females and the children. And so it came back to that ritualistic, cannibalism. And he hit it right on the head. The women and children got the internal organs, including the brain, that had the highest concentration of the prion protein. The men, if they consumed anything, consumed the finer cuts of meat, which have a lower concentration, but not nil.
So I don't know. That's just one of those social things that just kind of stuck with me,
It is it's pretty interesting story.
A bunch of people reached out, and some were very angry after Ted Nugent was on the podcast. And I don't know how CWD got brought up. I don't know what the context was. I don't remember. But I remember him saying that winter kills more animals than CWD does. And many people were very angry that this was a gross simplification of what could be a ticking time bomb.
I guess I would, I'd have to agree with that. There's another disease out there called epizootic hemorrhagic disease, EHD. And periodically you'll have significant outbreaks of this disease. And in northern latitudes where, the disease has not been present as often, you can see dramatic mortality. 80, 90% of a herd can be killed in a single, event. Okay? But a very, distinction between these diseases, EHD is spread by midges, little black no-see-ums. Okay?
A bug.
It's a bug. It actually transmits the disease, the virus from animal A to animal B or from the environment to animal A, either one. So while you have these pretty dramatic die-offs, as soon as the weather changes, after the first frost, the first hard frost kills off the midges, and within about 2 weeks, the disease cycle is broken completely. So it has significant impacts on a localized level periodically, but the disease cycle, there's a definite end to the disease cycle.
And then it's no longer present.
Well,
for a period of time anyway, right?
Yeah, the virus may persist in the environment, but once the transmission cycle is broken, the mortality stops.
And isn't there some genetically engineered food plots that they're putting together now, or different types of seed that inhibits midge growth and inhibits EHD?
I'm not aware of that, but I wouldn't doubt it.
And I think there's also some stuff they're doing that bolsters the animal's immune system. They're supplementing some of the food with, I don't know what they're using, but it bolsters the animal's immune system, makes them less susceptible to it.
And populations that have been exposed to EHD and over time definitely develop a herd immunity to it.
And is EHD transferable to humans?
No, we don't. Not that we've ever seen. There's no evidence that it is. This is a disease of deer, and it also can get into livestock.
So if people get bitten by these midges, there's still no concern that we could potentially get EHD.
Not EHD. Nope.
No.
So contrast that, this disease EHD, with a very definite end to the transmission cycle. First frost kills off the midges. With CWD, there's no known ecological factor which signals the end of the transmission cycle. So that's why we see prevalence, or the proportion of animals that are positive in individual, you know, locations, in individual herds. It just keeps going up, up, up. In captive facilities, the Hall Farm in Wisconsin, where CWD was first detected in 2002, the place was depopulated in 2006, prevalence was nearly 80%. So 4 out of 5 deer in that captive cervid facility had it.
Wow.
More recently, we had a deer farm in Iowa, where, you know, disease had gone undetected for some period of time. And when the herd was depopulated, again, about 80% prevalence, but this was a big herd. So there were over 200 positives in this single high-fenced enclosure. And so winter's not going to change that. It grows. So no stop. There's no known feature which stops the transmission cycle. And so when you say that something like EHD kills a lot of deer, yes, it does. But the disease transmission cycle stops. With CWD, we don't know anything that stops it.
EHD is more like the flu.
Have you had it on your farm?
EHD, never. No, no. Let me rephrase that. Not that I'm aware of. So when I learned about EHD and comparative diseases, you know, chronic wasting diseases, like none other. As it develops within the herd, as it develops within the animal, it just continues to grow. So it'll start out as a very small problem. There's some maps of how it developed or how it spread in the southwest Wisconsin. And we're on the front edge of it now. Correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but it's almost like the way it develops within the deer, taking that period of time before it becomes clinical and the deer dies, it's almost as if that's reflective of how it moves through the landscape. It moves very slowly, but once it's there, it's there.
Now, I have read about hunters eating meat from some sort of diseased deer and getting sick and dying. What would that be?
Misreporting?
Would it be?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I don't know. There have been instances where people that hunted deer later died of a prion disease, likely developed Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, okay? And so was it the deer that gave it to them? Well, there's no epidemiological evidence that this occurs at this point in time. And we've hinted about some of the human health issues. So there's a few things we can look at. In areas where CWD is known to exist, do we see higher mortality rates from Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, a prion disease of humans, than we do elsewhere? The answer is no. Okay, so from an epidemiological standpoint, there's no evidence that CWD has crossed over that species barrier into humans. Now, we can take a look at a number of science experiments that have been conducted. And at least in some of these studies, in experimental models, we have evidence that the CWD prion protein can cause human normal prions to convert to a disease-associated form, okay? But now these are models, okay? It's not quite the same as pumping CWD into the brain of a human patient and seeing what developed, okay? So the science suggests that there is a small non-zero chance that CWD could become a human health issue. There's also some of the more recent science that's been conducted suggests that this barrier, we call it the species barrier, and it really is a very robust barrier, one would think, that keeps CWD from crossing into human hosts. That barrier may not be as tough as we think it is, and that barrier may be changing over time.
And is that because one of the things that we've talked about before is that they've discovered different strains of CWD?
Yeah, it sure is, Doug.
Oh, Jesus.
So, yeah, so.
Well, like I said, man, it gets worse.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff.
You got to get to that point, it's that fascinating point.
It's definitely fascinating, but it's scaring the shit out of me already.
So, yeah, the idea of strains is really interesting. With scrapie, I mentioned that disease of sheep. We recognize some 30 different strains. And it's still all that same identical strand of amino acids, and its shape, that tertiary form, must be slightly different, and it manifests slightly differently in sheep. So now with CWD, there's at least two recognized strains that have been published in, you know, peer-reviewed literature. There's probably more strains out there. In fact, it's kind of interesting. There was a paper done a couple years ago which looked at the architecture of this disease-associated prion protein. And there's a portion of it that's referred to as a loop structure. And it's just kind of, you know, if you take a rubber band and or a piece of yarn or something and ball it up into a three-dimensional shape, there's a little loop hanging off the side of this disease-associated prion protein. And in deer, in CWD, that loop is very, very rigid, okay? It's very inflexible, shall we say. In humans, it is more of a flexible loop as opposed to the rigid loop. And it's thought that this difference in that architecture is partially, you know, controls that species barrier. Okay. So I was telling Doug.
I read the paper yesterday.
It's pretty neat stuff.
Okay? Yeah, it was really interesting.
So now it turns out mice, experimental laboratory mice, their prion protein has the same structure as the human prion does. Okay. So you cannot give CWD to a normal laboratory mouse. They just don't get it. And it's likely some of this difference in their prion structure. This one cannot convert that one to a different form. So some researchers in Alberta identified a strain of CWD which came from wild deer. So it's not something they engineered in the laboratory. They have a strain from wild deer that does give mice CWD.
Oh, fuck.
So most of the strains out there, mice can't get, but they discovered one that mice do get. So researchers from a few years ago, and lately I've seen it in the popular media, that, hey, this difference in this loop structure is going to keep people from getting CWD. Well, all the assumptions that people can't get CWD are based on this idea that CWD is CWD and it will always be exactly the same thing. But our experience with Scrapie strongly suggests that even though there's no DNA in these things, that they do change over time. They morph over time into slightly different disease characteristics and etiologic agents.
Now, in the hunting community, is there skepticism about this? Is Ted Nugent's ideas, are these unique, or is this a common thought that, or is it a convenient thought for them because they don't want it to be real?
It's a challenge.
Of education?
Yeah.
Whatever period of time that we talked here, it's really complicated, and it
right.
And to get to the, you almost want to stick your head in the sand and just mm-hmm. forget about it. And, you know, besides the sort of things that, you know, your friend that we were talking about before, like I was doing on the farm, of, you know, managing deer in a particular way for a particular kind of deer, which might be contrary to the spread of the disease. Well, geez, nobody wants to hear that I can't do what I want to. Yeah. Do management-wise.
And we're talking about management-wise, we're talking about my friend John Dudley's farm in Iowa, is that he only shoots the big, mature males, and he lets all the other deer grow to a very large size, so he has a really healthy population of big deer on his farm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are you doing in your place? I understand you're just on a mass call.
Well, I feel like I'm on the front edge. I don't feel like it. I am on the front edge of the spread of this disease, and there's some
in Wisconsin,
in Southwest Wisconsin. So, 15 years ago, or 16 years ago, when CWD was discovered, there were a lot of changes in hunting structure, and there was an effort by the Department of Natural Resources to eradicate the disease in the core area south of the Wisconsin River, about 70 miles from us. In 15 years, the disease has moved 70 miles north. That effort that the DNR started became political. And quite honestly, that many years ago, I would have likely been a little skeptical. Well, I know I would have been skeptical. You want me to do what? They wanted to kill all the deer in a particular area. you know, that many years ago, had they come to my farm and said, we're going to kill all the deer here and all the, you know, the neighboring deer, I would have had some real hard questions. I have no idea how I would have reacted to it. I continued to do, like, buck management, and, you know, you were there when we were still doing that. And there's, we can talk about, you know, how bucks contribute to the spread of the disease and that sort of thing.
Uniquely versus doe?
We see different prevalence or curves depending on the demographic faction of deer. Adult males, the ones with the big antlers, the deer's on the wall over there, tend to have higher prevalence, sometimes maybe 2, 3, 4 times as high as other segments of the population. So highest prevalence in adult males, followed by adult females, and then by juvenile animals. So it's likely behavioral reasons why we see that in adult males. So adult male deer, during the rut or breeding season, they greatly expand their home range. They contact multiple, you know, female or family groups of females. Earlier in the fall, especially with white-tailed deer, adult males tend to gather in these bachelor groups. So there's a lot of social contact, grooming, things like that. So because of their behavior, they contact more animals at different times of the year. And this number of contacts, it's believed, is likely responsible for them becoming infected at a higher rate than other members out in the herd. So now if you are an adult male, then you're in this group. You also have a higher likelihood of being able to transmit disease to other animals because you're out there during breeding season, right?
Is there any evidence that that any of these deer have transferred this to livestock, or that it's gone into agriculture, into food sources, to corn and what have you, that could be consumed by people even that are vegetarians?
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting question. So with regard to transmission into cattle, it's basically the same situation as with humans. No evidence that it has, but in an experimental sense, we can push it over that species barrier. Okay. Now, interesting you bring up plants, because we have shown research that we've done at the National Wildlife Health Center has shown that if you grow some plant types in a slurry, a concentrate of prion protein, that those prions can be uptaken through the roots and deposited into stems and leaves. Oof. Okay. And so that's one possible mechanism. A second is that so prions themselves, the disease-associated prions, tend to form very tight chemical bonds with various surfaces. And I showed him a paper on the way out here yesterday where they bind to just about anything. They bind to plants as well. So that deer that's out there with CWD positive, shedding infectious agent out into the environment through its urine, through its saliva, through its feces. So if a deer urinates, a deer with CWD urinates on plants, the prions have a tendency to bind to those plants, form a chemical bond. It's not just dried on. It forms a chemical bond to the plant.
So they literally become part of the plant.
It's, yeah, okay. So a deer could eat those plants, and that could be one of the possible transmission mechanisms. So that's the second one. The third one has, we speculated about, and some folks have looked at, and it has potential impacts for agricultural commodities. So when CWD was, you know, 20, 30 years ago, was really, really rare, it probably couldn't happen. But now it's in 25 states, vast geographic areas. We have just south of where he lives, in adult males, nearly 50% prevalence. So when you kill that big buck, take a coin out of your pocket, flip it in the air, and that's the odds that that deer has CWD.
And when he says just south, it's just 15 south. Miles.
Okay. So now let's go out west.
50% of them.
Yes. Or, you know, so let's go out
22% prevalence overall in the county at this point.
Let's go up into the big agricultural areas in Saskatchewan or out west. Okay. So you got a mule deer herd out there with CWD. And let's say maybe 20% overall of that herd is CWD positive. You've been out in some of those big wheat fields and hay fields. How many mule deer are standing out there before sunset?
A shitload.
Yeah. Okay. So take that amount times 20% or that amount, whatever percent have CWD. Figure out how many times does a deer defecate or urinate on a daily basis. and that's a bunch. And now think about the possibility that when you harvest those agricultural foodstuffs and roll it up into big bales, that you might have fecal material rolled up into those big bales.
Not just might, right? I mean, most likely.
We'd need a graduate student that we could have, you know, pick apart large bales of hay to really prove that. But, I mean, it's almost certainly.
Yeah. You know,
so now we're putting those on semi-trailers and moving them across borders.
The country. Yeah.
And are those – could – is there a possibility that these agricultural commodities, then deer could come up to them and be infected by contact?
I think
we
it's
don't
important
know.
To say that Brian's a scientist. These other folks studying it are scientists, and they don't – you know, it's evidence and it suggests, and they get attacked for that.
By people who don't want it to be true.
Well, and you know, that's how science is attacked anyway,
yeah.
right? Because it's hard to – speaking in absolutes is a real hard thing to do, you know. And so it's, you'll hear him say the evidence suggests.
Yes.
The information is this. And I just think that's a real important distinction to draw here that's, when you're having those kind of discussions. You know, there are people who want absolute proof.
Proof is hard in a biological world because there's so many factors out there. We can't control for them all. But there's certain tactics that have been used quite successfully. It goes all the way back to smoking. You know, when tobacco
science.
Companies were attacking science. And the whole idea is to sow the seeds of doubt.
There's a documentary on it called Merchants of Doubt.
We've seen that. We see the same thing going on with CWD. So you mentioned it earlier. Hey, you know, CWD, it's not so bad. What about winter kill? What about EHD? So instead of focusing on that, saying, don't look here, look at this one. This one is worse. Why aren't you doing something about this one? So it's a simple diversion. Another tactic, which is, and I mean, there's a body of science around
this. But this is a non-scientific approach to this because these are unrelated issues. Like EHD does kill animals. Winter kill most certainly kills animals, but we're not talking about the same circumstances.
Right. We're trying to divert the conversation.
Right.
Another thing that's very easy to do is, you know, is cherry picking the literature that's out there. We saw a real great example of this about a year ago where there's a lot of letters to the editor being sent into newspapers in areas where CWD is. And I think it's an attempt to change the conversation. So they were very careful to use citations from peer-reviewed literature. And one of the ones they used was they found that in researchers in Wisconsin found that CWD was not having a significant effect on mortality rates when they studied the disease. So this is a true statement taken directly from peer-reviewed science. What they didn't identify was that when they studied that disease was between 2003 and 2007, 10, 12, you know, 11 years ago. The next sentence in the paper was, our study can use as a baseline for comparison at a later point in time should disease change over time. So you mentioned that exponential growth curve and how early on, back in 2003 to 2007, this area, disease prevalence was probably lower than 5%. Now it shot up in that curve, and it's probably in that, you know, 25, 30, 30-plus percentage range. So you're cherry-picking literature to make your argument. So even scientists say this is not having a big effect when they studied it. They're just not saying when they studied it.
So as a non-scientist, what I'm looking at here is everyone's always terrified of the next pandemic disease. And this is one of the reasons why I felt it was so important to discuss this. Because, you know, people would say, they look at it casually, good, don't eat animals, don't eat deer. This is not that. This is something that has the potential to reach large-scale agriculture. This is, I mean, if you, one of the things about your farm, and we talked about this when we were there, is like, these animals are farm animals almost because they're absolutely free range. They're absolutely wild. When you talk about the deer on your place, you don't have them controlled in any way, but they're feeding off of your corn.
Yeah.
They're eating all this stuff that people eat. They're eating, I mean, that's what they eat. That's one of the reasons why the deer populations are so enormous in farmlands is because it's a massive food supply.
It's a perfect environment.
Yeah, and it's also one of the reasons why they're so delicious. They're so well-fed and so, you know, they're so, you know, nutritionally balanced diets. But the real what terrifies me is this potential for a pandemic disease also comes with an incubation period, and that we are looking potentially at, like, if you just objectively look with no hysteria and no hyperbole, you look at the history of diseases. Diseases mutate, and many of them come from animals. This is why swine flu and avian flu and all these different things have actually come from either farm animals or wild animals that have somehow or another managed to transmit diseases that have morphed and mutated and become dangerous and deadly to human beings. This, to me, seems like a ticking time bomb.
It has the potential.
One switch, one way or the other, like you've observed or they've observed, rather, with mice, and this could potentially infect human beings and spread across, I mean, the entire country like wildfire.
Well, we're seeing that spread right now in deer. You know, so in deer, we're seeing, you know, clear geographic spread. We're seeing clear increases in prevalence. And in areas where the disease has been present the longest, we are seeing population-level impacts. There's locations in Wyoming where we've demonstrated, where we've proven that CWD is driving population decline in deer. So that encapsulates why we should be concerned about deer.
And is this in mule deer?
That's in mule deer and in white-tailed deer.
And the mule deer have an extended range in terms of, like, their migration. That's one of the things that we've realized, I believe, over the last decade, right, is that mule deer travel far longer distances.
On average, than we ever thought before. Mm-hmm. Even whitetails can. There's an interesting research tidbit. The state of Minnesota, they've got what appears to be a fairly recent CWD outbreak in the southeastern part of the state. So their researchers are really trying to get ahead of this and figure out what could move this around. So they went in and captured deer in an adjacent area, put radio telemetry collars on these to see, well, just how far do they go? This was in an article just about a week ago, popular media article, so it's not published yet. But they had a doe, single doe, collared that went 80 miles. Pretty long distance.
Now, 80 miles circular or 80 miles point
80 miles
to point?
As the crow flies from point A to
one direction. Christ. Yeah. So in that 80 miles could potentially be spreading CWD if it was an infected deer. Throughout crops,
And then there's that exponential growth. So it's once it's there, sure, it takes a long time for it to become a large problem. And we're seeing that in Richland County. It crossed the river. Surveillance testing has been going on. It crossed the river, and it just keeps moving up.
And it could be in, again, all these different plants, all these different berries. People could be eating these berries, eating these plants, fruits, vegetables, all these different things, and they could be potentially consuming these prions.
Well, I think it's very clear that there's exposure. And I talk with Doug quite a bit about the difference between exposure and disease transmission, okay? So it is certain that lots of humans are exposed to disease-associated prion protein from CWD and likely from plant materials as well. Whether that will result in transmission of disease across that species barrier is an open question. We absolutely cannot say it will. We absolutely cannot say it will not. It's an open question, and one thing we can, though, identify very clearly is that the rate of exposure is increasing exponentially. As disease has a larger geographic footprint and prevalence goes up, more and more hunters are, just by simple math, being exposed to that positive material. So we're rolling the dice, and when you do biological experiments, I mean, there's a certain likelihood that you'll see outcome A or outcome B. So if you keep rolling the dice enough times, you might see an alternative outcome. We cannot rule that out.
So. When we talked about this when you were on with Renella and I at the farm, Meat Eater podcast number 70, Brian, you put it as the chances are very small at this point that it can. And this is what the CDC and the World Health Organization says as well. The chances are very small, minuscule even, but they're not zero. And I'm assuming that we continue to that continues to be the the concern. And I know you're talking a lot, Joe, about and I get it because after all, humans. But I've actually begun to focus more on the effect on the resource, on the deer. I mean, I tested positive animals. We properly disposed of the meat, which is a whole other, line of discussion. I'm still eating venison, but I'm not eating.
Are you testing the animals that you eat?
Yeah.
Every one of them. We test every deer killed on the farm.
Now, how long, when you raise a cow, how long before you kill it? Like how long do you
wait? Well, I do grass-fed beef, and
right.
This is actually kind of interesting. You were talking about the deer, the white-tailed deer on our place eating corn and mm-hmm. beans and GMO corn, GMO beans, alfalfa, whatever they want to eat. I control what my grass-fed beef eat. I mean, you've met some of my cattle.
Yes.
The one says hello, by the way.
Tell her so hi.
Anyway, but it's very controlled. So even though my deer
could be infected, your cow will not be.
Well, and that they're not organic.
Right.
My cattle are.
Right.
Because it is controlled.
How ironic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you have farm animals in captivity that are organic, purely eating grass, as nature intended, and you got deer eating Monsanto corn.
Yeah, believe me,
irony. It's kind of crazy.
And before anybody out there gets the idea that my cattle are confined in a little barnyard or anything.
No, it's a big, large area.
Big pasture. They're, they are, free ranging within that pasture, the pasture raised. So short answer, with grass-fed beef, I just sent four in. Unfortunately, none of it was ready. I was going to bring you some, but they just went in on Monday.
I would like to see them go through the security checkpoint carrying, bags of beef with them. But
26. So they were 2 years old and 2 years old in 2 months or 3 months.
Now, with the incubation period that you were discussing earlier, you're talking about a 2-year incubation period with deer before they potentially show any effects. So these animals would fall into that line between birth and slaughter, that would be inside that incubation window for deer. It could be potentially larger for cow. Is that correct?
BSC, I think the incubation period is between 3 and 5 years. And so that's why one of the precautionary measures for BSC in the United States is we don't allow those older aged cattle into the human food chain.
What does BSC stand for?
Bovine spongiform encephalopathy, a.k.a. mad cow disease. Okay. So that's one of the precautionary measures, is not allowing cows to get old for mad cow disease.
Well, right. And from my standpoint, mm-hmm. they're prime at 26, 27 months.
Right. And so when they are in an incubation period, they're still capable of distributing the disease, though, correct?
Well, that's with CWD and with scrapie in sheep as well. With BSC, and let me clarify, if CWD went into a cow in a natural world, we don't know exactly what it would look like. We know what it looks like when we inject it into the brain of a cow, but we don't know what it would really look like. But BSC is quite different in that, similarly with the human prion diseases, an individual with kuru could not give kuru to another human being. They mm-hmm. had to consume it, so that there was that artificial process involved. Same thing with BSC. A cow with BSC can't give BSC to another because they're not shedding that infectious agent out into the environment.
So when they stopped it, when they stopped feeding cows to cows.
Cow transmission cycle.
CWD is a different animal.
CWD and scrapie are different animals.
BSC times 10 on steroids.
Well, they're contagious.
Kind of freaking me out a little bit.
Because these animals are shedding, okay, that infectious agent. Cows with BSC are not shedding infectious agent. CWD-positive deer and scrapie-positive sheep are. These two diseases are unique in the world of TSCs. TSCs, the prion diseases, are unique amongst themselves, but scrapie and CWD are in a different world of their own. So,
okay, what, if anything, can be done?
Well, I try to break this stuff down to like the most basic levels so a guy like me can understand it. Buy time, pay for science. That's sort of one of the things. Slow the spread of the disease. There's a lot of work being done. All kinds of studies being done, different organizations and the government, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, not as much as we should be doing. We're a hotbed of it. I think that in Wisconsin, quite honestly, that we've become an example of how not to handle the disease. And a lot of the other states have begun to, take that idea that if you don't have it, you don't want it. So let's do what we can to stop it from coming here. That's why you're seeing things like let's not transfer carcasses. There's bans on being able to transfer carcasses. In Wisconsin, in some cases, you can't take it to another county. You can take the finished meat, so you have to bone your meat in the area, and then you can take it home, which, is a bit of a problem for some folks. We're beginning to stop the movement of captive deer from one farm to the other, but that's just recent, and there have been hearings on that lately. Yeah. So
people resist that, right?
Sure. If your economic vitality depends on selling and moving live deer, you're going to be opposed to restrictions on your economic activity.
But that is one of the primary infection sources.
It's one of the infectious sources. Yeah.
So he'll always correct you when you say something like primary.
What Doug's getting at is
no bullshit. He wants the he's going to like break it down.
It's the world I live in. We think of
there's
two mechanisms, primary mechanisms, if we lump them together for how CWD moves. One is deer to deer to deer to deer. That slow diffusive process of moving out on the landscape. That's really hard to deal with. The other one is this anthropogenic or human-assisted movement where humans are moving infectious material, and that might be how it got from Colorado to Wisconsin in the first place. It's highly unlikely that a mule deer or a white-tailed deer woke up one morning in Colorado and decided to, go 900 miles across the Mississippi River and settle in, western Dane County.
And back in the day, my dad and a bunch of his buddies used to go out to Colorado. And they, or Wyoming is actually where they went, and they hunted elk and mule deer, and they bring the whole damn thing back. I mean, just what you did, right? You put it on the back of the truck, and off you went. And then processed. I mean, can remember doing it in a garage in Casanova as a kid, working there with knives. This is a great thing. Well, what do you do with the bones and the non-meat stuff when you're done? Well, back in the day, we used to, and it still happens. We take it out and put it in we'd call it bone pile, a coyote pile or something like
Gets
that.
Gets dumped on the back 40. Where that still could have infectivity if it was a positive animal. So
how it was brought to Wisconsin is...
Who knows? But anyway, he's absolutely correct. The 25 states that don't have CWD don't want to get it. They want to do everything they can.
What states are these? Like, what is it, eastern states or?
Southeastern states and some of the far western states haven't picked it up. If you go to our website, you'll see a map there that shows the current known distribution of where the disease is. So the other states really don't want it. They don't want it bad. So it makes sense, to look at these anthropogenic factors, human-assisted, identify the possible mechanisms, how humans could bring CWD to you, and stop them, either with regulatory frameworks or with education. Teaching hunters that it's a risk to move carcasses around is likely much more effective than just putting a rule in place that says you can't do it.
And there are unscrupulous people who purchase deer from these high fence operations and release them in the wild because they want big racks and animals that, people don't know, there are these high fence operations. I shouldn't even call them high fence operations because some of them are wild animals that are contained in a fence. These are farms. They're farms that grow deer, and they grow deer with special protein feed, so they have enormous racks. So you have these really perverse perverse examples of a deer. And people look at that, to someone who enjoys wild animals, you see those and you're like, it's like a stripper with triple F tits. It's like, what the fuck did you just do? Like, these, they don't look real. They don't, like, they have like 80 points instead of like an 8-point buck, which is, you know, very typical, or a 10-point buck. You're like, wow, look at that monster. That's a natural animal that lives in the wild. They have these things that they don't even look like deer. They look like some cartoon.
But they're
like
bred specifically for
like that stripper with the triple F tits. There are dudes who go, I'm digging that.
Yeah, but it's obvious to all who are in the know.
Yeah.
Like, you go over a guy's house and he has one of those over his wall. You're like, did you just walk right out to that thing and put a pistol in its head like the deer hunter?
Yeah.
You know, like, what is that?
Yeah.
That's not even a wild animal. That's some weird science project.
Well, and genetics play a role, and sure. Brian will correct me when I start to veer off the science thing here, but genetics play a role in bigger deer.
Yes.
And your friend John Dudley would say he's doing it. The number one way to get big antler deer is it's not
let them
space
grow.
Let them get old.
Let them get old and give them plenty of food.
Yep.
Yeah.
But genetics have a role in it too.
Yeah, there's three factors in production of antlers. It's genetics, age, and nutrition are really the key three there. But now, you know, a lot of places will identify these as genetically superior. Well, that's kind of a misnomer. When you get back to the definition of fitness, genetic fitness, there's only one measure of genetic fitness, and that's how well represented you are in the next generation. Okay? So let's take an example where we took one of these, you know, 80-point whatever, and let's release it out into the wild. And during breeding season, it comes across a prime 3.5 or 4.5-year-old 8-pointer. You know, this physical specimen that you've witnessed them. They're unbelievable. So now if you put those up against each other in a mortal battle, I know who I'm putting my money on.
Yeah. The wild animal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Every time. And this is so these animals, while they're bred very much like livestock for very specific characteristics, big antlers, these don't necessarily translate into something that would be more fit out in the wild.
Well, let's also point out that the reason why you're bringing this up is these animals actually do fight to the death. And it happens all the time. They kill each other in combat. That's the reason why they have those antlers in the first place. They don't have them to protect themselves against wolves like caribou do. They literally have them to fight with. You know, female caribou have antlers as well, and they have these antlers so that they could try to fend off animals that are trying to eat them. There's a big difference between that and elk and deer. They have them for combat. That's why once the breeding season's over, they shed them, and then they start all over again.
Yeah. There's an interesting example if you look to history. It's an animal called the Irish elk.
Things were incredible.
They're extinct now. Okay, they were twice, three times the size of our normal elk, and their antlers were measured in feet instead of inches. Okay, and so during their evolutionary time period, when they were on the face of the earth, it was when, you know, animals were larger, predators were larger. These things got gargantuan. Okay, then they disappeared from the landscape, and at least, you know, the author Stephen Jay Gould. There you go, Stephen Jay Gould has offered up that likely. What occurred was a change in the habitat, that climate changed over time, and that forests grew up. If you're in the plains and you have antlers that are 7-8 feet wide, you can walk around. But now when trees start to grow up, how can you survive when the world around you changed? And you'd have to literally walk with your head turned sideways. And the Irish elk went extinct. So there's a very real example of how, you know, a phenotypic characteristic, these mega antlers, really in the long term, were not in the best interest of the species.
Jamie, pull up a photograph of these farm deer antlers. Just type in Google ridiculous farm deer antlers, and you get a sense of what we're talking about for the people that are watching this on YouTube, because until you see it, you don't really. You don't understand how gross it's gotten.
Yeah, I think one was called Goliath that I remember.
Well, there's there we go.
There you go.
Perfect example. That is a perfect example. What in the fuck is that? Because that's not a deer. Like that thing is, that's crazy what they've done to that deer.
It's a product of selective breeding for specific characteristics that some people will pay a lot of money for.
Yeah, and there's certain high fence operations that you can go online and they you know, this is what, like, look, go back to that photo you just had with that guy standing there.
Drawing.
Oh, it's a drawing. Yeah. Duh. You went too so quick. I thought it was real. Look at that thing. I mean, that is just insane.
Look at the one behind it, though.
Yeah.
Very normal looking deer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably a 1 year old.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are, this is, there's these places that have these animals, and some people will take these animals and then they import them. They purchase them, import them, and then release them into the air quotes wild, and then they'll hunt them, and then they'll pretend that that's a wild animal that they shot. And this is a source of CWD.
They are
potentially.
Well, okay, so a deer has to have CWD in order to be a risk, right? So it's been shown, I mean, in the lower 48, we're just, I think we're at 100 captive deer and elk facilities that have been shown to be CWD positive. So we can definitively identify that the captive servant industry has been a part of moving CWD across the landscape. We know that, you know, CWD positive deer have been moved by the industry even across, you know, international and state lines. Okay.
The ones in Korea are a great example.
Right. And even we had a recent one where a CWD-positive farm in Wisconsin, it can do tracebacks where this animal came from. It turned out it came from Pennsylvania, a game farm in Pennsylvania. And then doing testing in that source herd, they found additional positives there. So definitively. So now, while that's me, I'll say that very clearly the CWD or the captive industry is a portion of the equation. They're not the whole equation.
No.
They're not the whole equation. So
where did it originate? You said the first testing of the positive testing of this stuff was?
It was first described in 1967 in a research facility in the state of Colorado. Okay. That's not to say that was the first instance of CWD. It was the first time it was described in
so
research
animals.
So
this is pre-deer farms?
Well, I think deer farms have been around for a long time. There's, if you Google, you know, tame deer, you'll find some from the, you know, the late 1800s when photographs became possible of deer following people around. Mm. So we've domesticated animals for a long, long time. But as an industry, probably really came into vogue in, you know, maybe the 60s and 70s. And more recently now it's grown, you know, that industry has grown exponentially. Yeah, I used to work for Texas Parks and Wildlife before I worked for USGS. And one of the things I did was I administered the deer breeding program for the state. So when I started this, I didn't start the program, but when I came into that role.
What do you mean you administered it?
Well, deer breeders in the state of Texas, like many states, need a permit from a state agency to conduct those activities. Okay. And so I was administrating that program. I think there were around 120 licensed breeding facilities, white-tailed deer breeding facilities in the state at that point in time. You know, 10 years later, when I left Parks and Wildlife in Texas, there were around 600 or 700. So it just grew exponentially. And now I believe there are around 1,000 captive deer facilities in the state of Texas.
Jesus.
Pennsylvania, there's around 1,000 of them. Ohio's got several hundred. Wisconsin's got a couple hundred. Yeah, so like I say, they're part of the equation. But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to place all the blame for CWD moving it around because there's other possibilities for how this disease moves around. Doug hit on one of them, and that's the idea of carcass movement. It hasn't been proven that this occurs, but it's certainly, when you look at it from a scientific standpoint, it's very easy to identify. So if you know, I butcher my own deer, so if I kill a deer, it happens to have CWD, I butcher my own deer, I've got to do something with this stuff, okay? You know, the meat component in a deer is probably around 30, 35%, something like that. So I've got a lot of other stuff. Landfills, it turns out, are very loath to accept this material. You know, it's almost taboo now. Ooh, it might have CWD, so we don't want it at our landfill because the effluent might be pumped out onto a farmer's field and they could come back and, you know, they see it as a liability. So I've got my deer bones and offal, the rest of the material, and I drive to the dump, which is, you know, 25 miles away. I said, no, we're not taking that. Well, now what am I going to do with this stuff? So I could double bag it, you know, a little bit at a time, put it out in the trash, you know, Or maybe on the way home, I'm driving past a state-owned, a state park or a state natural area or a wildlife management area, and I see a trail go down there. And I drive down that trail, and, hey, there's a pile of deer bones and deer heads here. Whoops. Man, did I knock that over. Sorry about that, Joe. Apologize for that.
No worries. I've done it a thousand times.
So it's easy to see how inadvertently.
Just hold your thought when you're not on the microphone.
That's and it is one of the concerns is how are we what kind of hygiene do we have with the carcasses? And it is something that we're talking about a lot more in Wisconsin now, and it's become an issue. And interestingly, I'm in the County Deer Advisory Committee for Richland County, and we it's a citizen group, and we have some say in season structure and then how many antlerless permits there are. There's a lot of things we don't have any say in, which is, you know, fine. I'd rather leave it to the biologists, but because there are hunters involved, I'm happy to be one of them. One of the things that happened in our spring hearings is that we had folks come in and say, you know, we're concerned about chronic wasting disease and we don't want to spread it on the landscape, but when we put the bones out on the curb, they aren't taking it. On the Wisconsin DNR CWD website, there's a list of haulers who will take it. So there are some that will take it. There are some who don't.
But the problem is, where are they taking it?
Well, they're taking it to clay-lined
landfills.
And how it's being handled, there's some question, but it can be isolated so the effluent isn't being taken out and pumped onto fields. It's something that we can do something about.
Absolutely. There's clear science. So, you know, we noted how prions bind to various surfaces. They bind to clay particles very, very tightly. And so one of the researchers at UW-Madison, his name's Joel Pedersen, you know, was looking at this issue, 10 years ago to try and figure out, can it be safely done? Turns out if you put about an 8-inch clay liner underneath, one portion of your landfill, you can put all the deer and all the prions there that you want to, and while the prions will then migrate down, over time through the soil, when they come in contact with the clay particles, they bind, and they don't go anywhere. So it can be completely safely done. So there's a way to dispose of these materials very, very safely, but the thought of it, the risk associated with it, the liability, some landfill owners are just like, nah, we'd rather not.
And interestingly, because we were challenged about this, well, what are we supposed to do?
And you can't incinerate it, right? Because they'll...
Well, it ends up being a budget issue. In Wisconsin, everything's a budget issue. And the DNR is having, issues with that. And it is something that I'd like to talk about a little bit. But they were, when this all first happened 17 years ago, they were incinerating deer and it became a problem. But there are landfills that are taking it, and there are haulers who will take it. They have dumpsters that they use specifically for it. They're lined with heavy mill plastic. They're very specific to deer bones. But some haulers aren't doing it. So I contacted the head of solid waste for the state of Wisconsin and asked, well, how is this? I go on your website and I see some take it and some don't. And her response was, we have no legislative authority to require them to take this. So some are doing it voluntarily. And actually one solid waste hauler said to me, geez, we're putting a hell of a lot worse stuff in the landfills than, some deer bones. But it's simple hygiene. So one of the efforts that we're working on in Southwest Wisconsin right now is to place dumpsters in areas where I'm volunteering to have one on my farm. It's a question of who's going to pay for it, and if it comes down to it, I'm going to pay for the damn dumpster. They're about $500 for a 20-yard dumpster, but so that then people can come by and throw their put their bones in that dumpster, mm-hmm. and then they'll be properly disposed of because we have a hauler near us who's said we're willing to bring them there, to bring the dumpster there and then dispose of the bones properly, like they do with at one of the lockers that one of the butcher shops that processes deer. They have the setup, which is actually when I saw it, is when I was like, well, why aren't we doing that in you know, countywide in various places so that people aren't chucking them in the ditch. I mean, otherwise, you're holding on to the damn bones until you find out whether the things – if you're being completely careful about the hygiene, which we – I've been trying to do, all of a sudden you got a pile of bones in the old milk house down there until you find out whether it's positive or not. And I'm literally keeping it, the deer bones separate so that when I find out that deer A was non-positive, well, okay, I can put those out or something like that. So that's one of the things. There's a difference between what we can – there's natural spreading of the disease. And then there's human, like, putting them on trucks and moving them around or taking the bones around and doing
this
that.
This carcass thing is really a low-hanging fruit. And the idea that we can't fix this one, I mean, that's ridiculous.
And it's easy. It seems easy to me. I mean, it's just a matter of will and money and education, obviously. That we're providing opportunity for this. I've been working with the DNR a little bit on this, and we're in some discussions about two things. One is self-service kiosks, so to make getting your deer tested easier, where you essentially cut the head off the deer and leave it in a kiosk with some information about where it was. And, it, you know, they're fairly simple. They've been doing this for a couple of years on an experimental basis. But, again, it becomes a budget issue. So we're hoping that what we're going to be able to do is start something called Adopt a Kiosk, essentially, that hunters and people or sportsmen's groups will gather those heads and then take them into the testing facility and therefore, you know, keep the budget money targeted at doing the actual testing. Right next to that self-service kiosk really should be a dumpster that you can throw your deer bones into, whether you know whether it's positive or not. Otherwise, you are holding it. The other thing that the DNR suggests that we do is if you kill the deer on your farm, leave the bones on your farm. Makes sense to me.
So that way, if it is positive, disease is already there, and so you're not taking as great a chance of moving it. That's not an optimal solution to leave that stuff on the ground surface. An optimal solution is dig a hole, but, you know, it's pretty hard to dig sometimes in December in Wisconsin.
Well, so. if the dumpster thing doesn't end up working out with me, there will be a hole. I mean, last year I just kept the bones separate, and the ones that we I actually took the from the one deer they went into the dumpster at the locker.
This all seems to me, sorry to interrupt, but this all seems to me like Band-Aids on massive gunshot wounds.
It is, but go back to what I was saying before. Let's buy time.
Right.
Because this shit's spreading, man.
Yeah.
Let's buy time and pay for science, not, there's nothing we can do about it. Or the other one, that it's always been here, which I think the guitar player talked about. Yep.
Is there any consideration whatsoever that there could potentially be a cure?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we hit on a couple of things. I think it's important to talk just very briefly about some very generic disease management practices. Number one, and this would be wildlife disease, human disease, livestock disease. Prevention, number one. If you don't have it, don't get it. Do everything you can. That's why we get vaccinated, okay, for various diseases. If you do get disease, do everything you can to keep from moving it artificially. So that's why we don't want to move the carcasses around. That's why, you know, we don't want to move captive deer around. That's why when we had an Ebola outbreak in 2015 in Liberia on Ivory Coast, we stopped commercial airline flights. We didn't want people inadvertently moving it out. So prevent, don't move it around. Conduct surveillance around areas where it is to see what's going on. And states are doing that very well, largely. The next one is a tough one. Do something about disease. Manage disease to try and knock down prevalence, incidence, and get rid of the disease. So that's challenging. But two other things. Number one is support research, because if we don't have a cure today, we won't have one tomorrow either.
How is research funded right now?
Either by states or by the federal government. And there's not a ton of money. The last one is being transparent with your stakeholders, being open and communicative with them. So with many diseases, we have good therapeutics, okay? We can treat some diseases. CWD and other prion diseases, we have no therapeutics. We have no treatments right now. but people are certainly working towards them. Now, it's going to be very challenging to create a therapeutic, something that treats a prion disease, because treatment would then mean you would have to get past the blood-brain barrier. And once you start this cascading interaction of normal prions to disease-associated prions in the central nervous system, it's going to be really, really challenging to stop that. I mean, it's a roller coaster gone awry by the time it gets up into the brain. So then you're looking at preventative measures. The idea of vaccines is number one. And number two is looking at animals that, through their genetic profile, are resistant to disease. And there's some advances on each front. So we can talk about vaccines for a moment. Individual scientists, research outfits have been trying to develop vaccines for TSEs, for prion diseases, for a long time. Okay? None have been successful. There's no human prion disease vaccines. There's nothing for BSE. There's nothing for scrapie. But there's research ongoing, and there have been some advances. There's a Canadian research group that had a vaccine candidate for CWD. They thought it looked very promising, so it went to a field production stage. And they actually tried deploying this vaccine in a captive facility in Wyoming, okay, a research facility. It turned out that this vaccine was not ready for prime time. And actually, after giving this vaccine to some elk, giving a placebo to other elk, and then leaving him in a CWD-contaminated facility, actually the vaccinated animals got CWD faster and at a higher rate than the non-vaccinated animals. So it turned out to be almost an anti-vaccine. Okay, so it didn't work.
Instead of being inert, there was some sort of active CWD in the vaccine? Is that what it is?
No, it just, for whatever reason, it predisposed the animals. So it was a massive failure, but even from failures, you learn. Okay, so they're working now, and they learned a lot in that experiment. There's another research group centered out of the University of New York who published a paper, I think in 2015 was their most recent work. And they've got a vaccine candidate that provides some degree of protection, quote-unquote protection from disease. Now, all but one of the animals that they gave this vaccine to and then challenged with CWD got CWD. Okay, so that's not good news. But the average incubation time was extended something like 300 days. Okay, so they're on the right track. They have a mechanism that is somehow interfering with the conversion from normal host prion protein to the disease-associated form. So very valuable. Now, will they get there? We don't know. But think about it. Even if we do create a vaccine that works, that prevents CWD, and prevent as opposed to slowing, there's a very big distinction. So if you have a vaccine that makes the average course of disease 3 years instead of 2 years or 4 years instead of 2 years, they still have CWD.
Are there not any good deer farms that have 100% negative CWD deer in them? Like none of them test positive?
The vast majority of deer farms have never had CWD.
The vast majority.
Absolutely.
So there is a potential that you could isolate these populations of completely CWD-free deer, and if there's some sort of a mass die-off, you could reintroduce these deer into the wild?
Well, okay, so you're looking at the difference.
I'm talking about just a giant die-off.
So you're looking at the difference there between a herd that is CWD-free, which means it likely hasn't been exposed to CWD, versus animals that are CWD-resistant through genetics, okay?
Right.
So to date, we have not seen any deer that are genetically completely resistant. There are different genotypes of the prion protein gene out there that do impact the length of disease and also seem to have some impact on how often the frequency that these animals get disease. But even the genetically resistant deer do get CWD. Okay,
and they transmit it.
They get it at a lower rate. They likely transmit it. They're likely shedding infectious agent. So instead of that kind of garden variety 2 year incubation period, it might be closer to a 5 year incubation period. So now, on the one hand, you're going, great, most deer die before they're 5 years old anyway, so this would be a good thing. But on the downside, you're talking about a population of animals that have CWD with all these other side effects. They're shedding infectious agent out into the environment, this, that, and the other, and, you know, cause a, you know, a potential risk to human and other health impacts on the landscape. So I'm not so certain that this is a success story. Just like a vaccine that results in a longer course of disease where deer can get CWD, but they die from something else, a population of resistant animals that have a high prevalence of CWD, I guess I don't see that as a desirable endpoint because of the other consequences and potential repercussions of CWD.
It would
CWD.
Almost be more desirable if it killed them instantly.
A shorter incubation period would be preferable.
Yeah, because then you have it's almost like engineering deer to survive longer gives them more potential to spread it.
Absolutely. Jeez. So now, recently, there's claims that, and there's research going on in some of the cervid farms, the deer farms, that they've identified genetic markers, ones that are not published in the literature yet, that are affording a higher degree of protection from disease. But until it's published in the peer-reviewed literature and really tested, it's a speaking point until that point in time. So we don't know if they'll get there.
We got to put a fence around Wisconsin, Doug. Giant one, 30 feet high.
Well, it's, you know, there's 30 feet it's already into northern Illinois, northeast Iowa.
All the places that have it, 25, so we're half and half.
Yeah.
Well, Alaska doesn't. Does Alaska have it?
Not that we know of.
No. Hawaii?
No.
No. Okay. So lower 48, 25, it's more than 50% then. More than 50% of the states have it. Wow.
25 out of 48. Yep, you're there.
So this is something that it just can't be dismissed. This is not something that's a hoax. This is not. So the reason why people were upset at what Ted said on the podcast, there's a very good reason.
Well, so, look, if I want to, I play guitar, and if I want to learn some kick-ass Detroit guitar riffs, I'm going to listen to Ted Nugent. If I want to learn about CWD, I'm going to listen to Brian Richards and guys like him.
Well, the thing is, Ted does know a lot about hunting, and he knows wildlife, and he knows a lot about conservation, but it appears that he's very misinformed or underinformed about this.
Let me try and put this in perspective. Okay, so you have a disease which is contagious. It's always fatal upon clinical presentation.
Always fatal, 100% fatal.
Yeah, deer don't survive. Humans don't survive prion diseases. When it enters the central nervous system, it's a death sentence. Okay? So it's contagious. It's fatal. Neurodegenerative disorder. It's got to be a horrible way to die. Okay? So that's a pretty significant set of clinical signs or symptoms in an individual animal. Right? Okay. Now let's look at the geographic spread, rampant geographic spread. So it has an ever-expanding geographic footprint. In areas where it has been known the longest, we now have prevalence in a cohort of animals, adult males, of around 50%, and in adult females, around 30%. Can you name any other disease of humans, fish, domestic livestock, dogs, wildlife, anything else that has that set of characteristics and that degree of penetrance into the population, and you go, "Yeah, that's no big deal." I'm not aware of one.
There isn't one. No, this is obviously very, very significant, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys on.
I wanted to ask Jamie to pull up some photos of clinical CWD deer or elk. I think you had some, and then you kind of took them down.
Maybe. Photos of the ones that are infected?
Sick, yeah. Oof. Yeah. So, again, 24-month plus or minus incubation period in the last 6 to 8 weeks are clinical. You know, I got to tell you, man, I killed this deer, and he tested positive.
Whoa.
Yeah. Tested positive, and
that is awful.
That one's not CWD.
Yeah.
That one
not?
Could be. Not the one before.
No, the that one.
What is that?
That's got some other.
That was called, that's cutaneous fibromas. They're tumors that grow on the surface of the skin. Pretty grotesque looking, but.
What's the cause of that?
It's a virus.
Is it fatal?
If you get those warts and those fibromas on your eyes and they block your vision, it would be. Mm. But otherwise, it's a stressor on animals, and you can actually eat them. They're fine, but I don't think I would.
Chronic wasting disease.
That image that Jamie's got up there, the larger image, scroll down. What is that?
That's likely CWD. Yes, absolutely. Pick the one that's on the row underneath the second one from the left. That one that the buck there.
The rib
that's,
cage buck?
Yeah, no, that's a photograph. That no, one, no, nope, you had
the,
it. You
the
had
one with
it.
That one there?
So that was taken by a game warden. Michael Hopper is his name in the state of Kansas. And he's, you know, this disease has a pretty decent footprint in Kansas. As a game warden, he gets calls about deer acting funny. And so he's taken a number of good pictures. If you can zoom in on that photo, I don't know if you can, look at what's coming out of that deer's mouth. See that stream of saliva?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all filled with infectious material. So that's one of the clinical signs is this hypersalivation.
That's a wild deer.
That's a wild deer.
So it's almost like this disease is trying to spread itself.
It's pretty efficient, yeah.
Yeah, but by doing that, by forcing these animals to have all the saliva excretion, this is a very effective means of transmitting this disease throughout the
set of characteristics of this whole disease, where the protracted incubation period, shedding infectious agent through bodily fluids for the majority of that incubation period, the infectious agent persists in the environment for years out to decades. I mean, if you wanted to stack the deck for a disease, you couldn't come up with a better set of characteristics. Plus, they look perfectly healthy, so we have no idea. Yeah, that they're diseased until later on in the disease progression.
Now, is there a prevalence higher prevalence in deer versus moose versus elk or anything else?
We tend to see higher prevalence in the deer species, white-tailed deer, mule deer, in isolated areas than we do in either elk. Moose, there's only been, you know, worldwide, there may have only been 10 positive moose, okay, to date. And it's likely, and it doesn't seem that they're less susceptible. It's just that they likely haven't been exposed because they're not in the same systems.
And moose tend to be
solitary.
Solitary, and just, fewer.
Do you have moose in Wisconsin?
They can, you know, periodically a yearling will wander down from northeastern part of Minnesota, but very, very rare.
What about wolves? Have wolves contracted it yet?
Wolves are an interesting story. So to date, there's no evidence that any canid, any member of the dog family, has ever developed any TSE. They never got BSE as far as we know. No evidence that any canid has gotten CWD. Now, that could be a real observation. It could also be that we haven't done enough science on it. Okay, but there's certainly exposure. As opposed to cats, in the BSE situation, both great cats and domestic cats got a TSE. It was referred to as feline spongiform encephalopathy, and it was from consuming BSE-contaminated meat. Okay, very
so
similar
cats,
to how humans
lion, mountain lions.
Yeah, great cats.
Which most certainly consume deer on a regular basis.
Now, with CWD in North America, we have no evidence that any mountain lion or any great cat or small cat has contracted CWD. Mm. In fact, it's very interesting. In a research study in Wyoming that I was a part of, it turned out that the highest source of mortality for CWD-positive deer was mountain lion predation. And so somebody's going, aha, CWD doesn't always kill deer. Well, but it predisposes them. So think about that progressive neurological degeneration and think about how mountain lions hunt. They're ambush hunters. Mm-hmm. So if you're a deer and you're not quite right, you know, I mean, this disease is developing in your brain, you're progressive dementia. It's not at the point where we, our human eyes, which really are very, very poor, we can't see disease yet, but disease is progressing, and an ambush predator can leverage that and take advantage of that in that weakness in the prey. We see the same thing in Colorado. Studies have identified that CWD-positive deer tend to get hit by cars more often than CWD-negative deer. Mm. It's very logical.
Yeah.
So now let's extend that to wolves and ask the question, could wolves be a management tool for CWD? Okay. Wolves are present in northern Wisconsin, you know, a lot of other locations. And at some point, wolves and CWD will meet. So there's been mathematical models developed, which are, there's a lot of assumptions built in those models, but it leaves it as an open question. Could a large coursing predator whose vision and senses are much more acute than ours, could they take advantage of this disease in earlier stages? And so when disease meets geographically wolves, could wolves slow or maybe stop the progression of disease?
Because they're taking the weak and the...
The sick and the old.
But they still wouldn't stop the excretion, and they still wouldn't stop all of the bodily fluids.
Right.
They still wouldn't stop the...
Could they slow the spread or stop the spread? Maybe. Could they reverse disease? You could likely take all the predators you could find, wolves and mountain lions, and dump them, you know, into Iowa County, just south of where Doug lives, and they likely would not be able to eliminate disease. But at that, but as disease spreads geographically at the interface, could predators be an effective tool to slow or stop disease from spreading? It's an interesting question, especially when states are contemplating more aggressive control measures, opening up hunting and trapping seasons to reduce population densities of wolves. So we don't have good tools, and I'll leave it an open question. Do we want to take that potential tool and take it out of the toolbox?
And so a wolf, a coyote by us, you know, they're eating deer die in our woods, you know, from, we found a dead one last time Steve was there, and I was very suspicious of it being a CWD because it was a 2.5-year-old buck. It was laying there, and it turns out it was probably hit by a car, but it was fairly well consumed by coyotes by then. And I cut the head off of it and sent it in, and it came back non-positive. What happens when that coyote, which is going to travel, well, they aren't traveling huge distances, but say he's eaten a CWD positive deer on the Duren farm, and he's running over to Bunker Hill 7 or 8 miles away because they do that, and he takes a dump
out.
Over
yep.
there.
Yeah, we've done that. Science has been done, and so it turns out if you take CWD positive material, you put it in the front end of a coyote, it comes out the back end of a coyote, and it's still capable. It's still infectious. There's still infectivity in it. It's capable of transmitting disease.
Now, you said mice don't get it. Rats eat coyote poop, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they don't get it, though.
Not that we're aware of.
But they could potentially spread it in their urine because they would be carrying it.
So that coyote, you have to ask, so you could eat CWD-positive material, you could poop it out X number of hours later, and he might be a mile or two away. Okay, so that's a fairly local geographic phenomenon that could be spreading infectious material. Now, you have to ask yourself, you know, more questions when they defecate on the landscape. Is a deer likely to encounter and consume that material? Well, maybe not now, but it might be fertilizer 2 years down the road for plants that the deer could eat. So, but I think that's quite restricted. It's a localized geographic phenomenon, okay?
And not something that we can do a hell of a lot about.
It's hard to.
Yeah.
Same thing with crows. You can put CWD in the front end of a crow or probably other scavengers, and CWD comes out the back end about 4 hours later. So you could ask yourself the question, how far does a crow fly in 4 hours, and is a deer likely to consume crow poop? So these have been shown to be possible in a laboratory environment, but how much they really apply out in the field is of question. So we go back. We know that deer to deer to deer to deer, we see that slow diffusive process on the landscape. That's the biggie that's going on just south of him and now is past him. Then we have that anthropogenic movement, you know, humans moving at long distances and the potential for agricultural commodities to be involved. I mean, there's likely other things like crows and coyotes. They're proof of concept in a laboratory, but whether they're really happening in the field is an entirely open question. And if they are, how big are they as compared to these other features?
So why not do the some of the detractors will also say, well, you can't stop deer from doing deer activities, right? Licking branches, licking each other, those normal deer activities. But if we're concentrating them in an area, let's say a mineral lick, where every deer in the area comes through there and licks that, and they're
or a feeder,
and a bait pile, we've seen bait. I've seen bait piles where there's a pile of corn, there's a pile of apples. Well, they're all eating off the same pile. You got all these deer coming into that. That's something we can do something about. There are all these natural movements that we can't do anything about. But if we can slow the spread by stopping these unnatural gatherings of deer and these unnatural spreading of the disease, why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah, there's a few things. We keep honing in on, there's these anthropogenic factors. And then what can we do where disease is, truly is? Yeah, the things you're talking about, the baiting and feeding, artificial congregations of animals, okay? In where TB is in Michigan, you can't bait and feed. And in Wisconsin, some of the other states where CWD is, you can't bait and feed deer. The idea is you're artificially congregating them. So remember that single deer, we saw him up there on the screen, who's shedding, copious amounts of saliva. So if that deer goes up to a pile of corn on the ground, he's sharing, spreading infectious agent into that corn. It can persist on that corn for a long, long time.
Decades.
Healthy, naive, susceptible animal comes up and eats that corn or licks that mineral lick. And it's likely that that animal is ingesting viable infectious agent and can transmit disease. The analogy there is daycare. Okay? If you want to get your kid sick, your three-year-old kid sick, what's the best place to do it? Send them to daycare, okay? Yeah. Daycare, the analogy there is that pile of corn on the ground. Mm-hmm. So if every child that ever goes to daycare is perfectly healthy, they're not little disease factories. But we know that's not the case. Right. So they're a great place, and schools are a great place to spread disease. And then those kids come home and share it with you, and then you can share it with others, right? Mm. Same thing there. So these artificial congregations, if all the deer are healthy— well, then they can't be a place to transmit disease. But we know that's not the case. So it's one of those risk factors we can control. But now you hit, Doug, we get back to this area where disease is established. Is there anything we can do? And there's certainly things we can try, right? We haven't exhausted the toolkit yet. Mike Samuel at UW is now retired. He looked at this from a mathematical perspective, and he's trying to leverage the idea that adult males have higher prevalence, right? So they are sinks for disease, they're gathering disease, and then they're shedders of disease as well. So what if in our harvest regime, in hunting season, we focused on adult males, okay? We hammer the bucks, because they're the ones most likely to have disease. So we would lower prevalence in that we're reducing the proportion of the population with the highest prevalence of disease. The idea is if you knock that segment down enough that you would interrupt disease transmission cycles and you could actually lower herd prevalence over time. Now, you still have the persistence in the environment, but from a modeling basis, it works. All right, so now think about the deer hunter out there listening to me today, listening to this show today. Oh, now they want us to go out and kill all the bucks. So it's not going to be a very desirable, from a hunter's perspective, tool. So all the tools we have, you consider these like medicine for a disease, they're very bitter.
It is a bitter pill. You were there when we were still doing wearing the sombrero, if you... shot a smaller buck or whatever, and we had a management idea that we wanted to grow some bigger bucks, but at the same time we were pretty lenient about it. We're not doing that anymore. The deer I shot last year were deer that 7-8 years ago I wouldn't even take another look at. First buck I shot, the first buck I had an ethical shot at.
Now, are they giving you more tags or
working? There's resistance in the hunting community to that.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. I'm not one of those people. We are I'm part of the County Deer Advisory Committee again. We're giving more doe tags or antlerless tags because the other part of it, sure, we have a population, the bucks, that because they're sinks, as he said, and they're spreading the disease, And they're traveling more. You know, a doe and her family tend to kind of stay in one area a little bit more, where the bucks have a bigger range. But the other thing is population. So one of the things that, for a couple of different reasons, I mean, you saw the number of deer that we have in our place. In Richland County, we have in excess of 75 deer per square mile of habitat. And I know there's places in the country that are higher than that. But, you know, it's sort of a... It's a big population, and I have issue with it for a few different reasons. One of them is disease. The other one is that when I have too many deer, my little oak trees are getting, because they love those little oak trees, and they're getting chewed off, and I'm trying to do multiple things. I'm not just trying to raise deer on our farm, mm-hmm. And on our woodlands. So, you know, that's one of the issues. So there's this demographic issue that Mike Samuel had been working on, but then there's the population issue as well. We're given four. When I was a kid, when you bought a buck license, you and four other dudes would get together and then fill out this form and send it in like August to get a what was called a party tag, and you could shoot one doe between four people because we had they were trying to manage the herd to have more deer. Because again, when I was a kid, seeing deer was a big deal. It's the exact opposite now. So. Now you get a buck tag, and you get four antlerless tags with every tag that you buy in our county.
What changed from when you were a kid, where the population exploded?
Well, management was a big part of it, and the management exploded is, I mean, I'm going to be 60 years old, Joe. It wasn't exactly.
You look great.
Well, thank you very much. As do you.
Thank you.
and Brian, you look pretty good too.
Pretty good. Yeah. He's like, what the fuck?
Jamie, on the other hand, over there, I don't know.
He's the young buck amongst us.
No kidding.
But, no, of course. That's a pretty long period of time. And when you're controlling, because you don't have many deer, and you're managing to increase the deer herd, and you have a mentality out there that, well, I'm not going to shoot a doe because, you know, those are the... and they're having... two fawns, and this year, at least in my area, we're seeing a lot of does having three fawns. That's you can see how that growth of the herd would be pretty dramatic.
If you want a herd to grow, stop shooting does. If you want to take a herd down, you know, shoot does. Remember back in grad school in Illinois, they gave away these little pins that hunters collected. And when you brought a doe into the registration station, you got a pin that said, I shot a doe so the herd won't grow. You know, people collected these little mementos.
That's interesting.
So during, you know, that time frame, like I said, I grew up, you know, a couple counties to the north and west of where Doug was. And in the, you know, in the 1960s, I mean, there weren't a lot of deer around there. And watched, you know, as I grew up, you know, we didn't shoot many does. The regulations in the state didn't allow you to shoot does. By 1980, on opening day, I remember I counted 160 deer on opening day. 15 years before that, probably saw three, something like that.
Wow.
So exponential growth in the deer population over that point in time.
The deer management program worked really well.
Oh, yeah. We know how to grow deer.
And then along with all of that we've already talked about, the agriculture and the...
The agriculture expanded.
Well, I don't know that agriculture,
expanded.
But yeah, but, you know, it was always there. So it had the potential for all of the, mm-hmm. you know, for this mm-hmm. explosion.
So there's a interesting, you know, I talk with folks in the state of Michigan, and they've got a issue, you know, relatively recent likely issue with CWD. And, you know, there's user groups out there that are trying to advise the state on how to manage CWD. One of the groups is, you know, is talking about, it's called antler point restrictions, okay? The idea is a, you know, a yearling buck, 18 months old, has fairly small antlers. And then as they get older, they typically get successively larger antlers. So a group is out there right now as an active proponent of implementing antler point restrictions and promoting antlerless harvest at the same time, okay, as a disease management tool. So as we noted, you know, lowering the population –
CWD
is beneficial in that if we have a herd of 500 animals with 10% prevalence, that's 50 positives, versus a herd of 20 animals with 5%, which would be one, and that's a dramatic difference. The prevalence is the same, but we have fewer positives out there, right? So lowering populations overall does make sense with regard to disease, okay? But now the other part of antler point restrictions is allowing males to get older. And they argue that that will keep hunters engaged. And if hunters are engaged, they'll shoot more does and keep the population down, and that'll be a good thing. But, you know, we've already discussed how adult males tend to have the highest prevalence of CWD, okay? And so now you're talking about pushing more males into these older age groups in an area where CWD is already known to exist. And so from a biological perspective, from a numerical modeling perspective of disease, I fail to see how this can work. Mm. So will it keep hunters engaged? That's a sociological question that I can't really address. But from a purely biological, disease-driven process, promoting more older-aged animals, older-aged deer in a population with CWD, I cannot figure out how that could be beneficial.
It seems the opposite. I'm hoping that through this podcast, this information becomes more digestible. Because I think that in order to get what you just laid out over 2 hours, in order for someone to get that by reading, it's like they're not going to do it. Most hunters are just not going to do it. So I have a feeling that, like what Ted Nugent had said, that this is his perspective is possibly way more prevalent than should be. And because this information is not that digestible, I think that there's, you know, I know you talked about it on Meat Eater episode
70.
And then now today, this is going to reach a lot more people, and it's in a very digestible form where they can just sit down and listen to it, and hopefully we can get the word out on this in a way that it's not getting out now so people understand the consequences of this. This is a real issue, and if this is not simply like, hey, we don't want to do this because this could negatively impact our hunting opportunities. We might not have any hunting opportunities in 10 years or 20 years. Like this literally could devastate the entire population of deer. This is not it's not a simple thing. This is an incredibly complex thing with a terrible disease that is 100% fatal and is absolutely spreading.
No question. Some of the take-home points I always think, and I get regularly asked by hunters, well, what can I do? Okay, well, what do hunters do? They sit at deer camp and they shoot the crap around, you know, whatever, libations or whatever. So, and they're going to talk about things like CWD, and good. So let those conversations be driven by fact and science as opposed to rumor and innuendo.
Right.
Okay? That's what we're doing here today, and that's why I think this public information is so important. There's other things it can do. We talked to, Doug hit on a bunch of them. You know, hunting is part of promoting a healthy deer herd. Keep hunting. Keep populations low. Test your deer. And manage those carcasses. Don't leave them out on the landscape. There's another category, though, of things that can be done. You know, in deer camp, what's the easiest thing to do? Is blame the DNR for everything, the Department of Natural Resources. Okay, it's almost a sport to kick around at night and see who can insult the DNR the worst, right? So with regard to disease, though, is that really an effective use of your time? It might be fun, but it's likely not effective, because think of these state management agencies that deal with deer. It might be the Agriculture Department or the Natural Resources Department. They're very, very restricted in what they can do. They operate within a legislative framework. Okay? So if you really want to impact change in how a government agency goes about its business, should you talk to the local biologist or should you talk to the elected leader who establishes the legislative framework that agency works underneath?
It's important to put pressure on our elected representatives. And we've seen change in that in Wisconsin being a great example. Our management used to be science-based, wildlife biologists making decisions about deer management. It's politically based now. Politicians are deciding what you'll often hear that in Iowa County, Wisconsin, where this first effort started. It didn't work up there. DNRs, they had this idea and it didn't work to stop the disease. It didn't get a chance to work because a
Social people, and political pressure.
Social and political stopped
forced the DNR to vacate their plants and their aggressive measures. And even more recently, there was a court case. The state of Missouri, the Missouri Department of Conservation, tried to implement some restrictions on the captive cervid industry to stop importation of live deer, seeing them as a risk factor. The deer breeders sued the state, went through the court system, and it was decided by the Supreme Court in the state of Missouri about 3 weeks ago that, in fact, all deer are, represent wild deer, and that the Department of Conservation was well within their constitutional and legislative authority to implement measures designed to protect the integrity and viability of that deer herd for future generations. So the Supreme Court said, yes, Department of Conservation, you do have the right to restrict import of animals into captive cervid facilities to protect the integrity of the herd.
And the legislative part of it is really important, and I can't put too fine a point on it. Laws can be changed, and there's pressure to do that under a lot of different reasons. I've been a part of changing some legislation. It had to do with forestry, and I know how it's done. One of my favorite quotes from Ella Leopold is, "Ethical behavior is doing the right thing, even when no one's watching, and the wrong thing is legal." So just because it's legal doesn't mean it's the right thing to do, and it doesn't mean it's the ethical thing to do.
Is there any potential to changing the limits, tag limits, or making them more widespread if they understand the issue with this and they understand that one of the main tools of handling this in a more effective manner and slowing the population or slowing the spread of this disease through the population of deer is reducing the population itself? I mean, even these hunters would resist this because it would limit hunting opportunities. This could potentially be a large tool in the toolbox of conservation and stopping the spread.
Short answer on that is yes. As I said, I'm on the County Deer Advisory Committee. We have the opportunity to give out as many antlerless tags as we want.
What about antler tags? Because that's the issue,
one.
Right? One. That's it. One per person?
And that is legislatively control.
But even with this disease, which that might be the number one tool to
absolutely
slow down the spread.
We used to have a policy in Wisconsin called Earn a Buck, and it was not particularly popular with a lot of hunters because, I want to shoot my buck, and I don't want to have to shoot an Earn a Buck. You had to shoot a doe or an antlerless deer to earn a buck tag. And it wasn't particularly popular.
That's really a mild way to put it.
Mm. Well,
it was vehemently opposed.
Vehemently opposed by a very noisy group of hunters, just like, and again, with my experience with working with the legislature, a small group of people making a hell of a lot of noise with a certain amount of money can change things. It wasn't popular. It was popular with me you hunted on my farm. We shoot way more antlerless deer than we shoot bucks. When Earn a Buck was in place, we'd have a stack of buck tags because we were shooting so many does. That was because it was politically or socially became a political issue. It was rescinded. And so now what we found in Richland County is we could drop antlerless tags from a helicopter, shoot as many as you want. And we're still going to kill
about the same number of does.
About the same number of does. There's been a little bit of an uptick. But when we had Earn a Buck, we killed a shitload of them, three times as many. And it becomes and I understand, especially like casual hunters, like, gun hunters are a good example. And bow hunters are, different example because they're not as casual, but they're more interested in killing the big buck. Generally, gun hunters, you go out there for 2 or 3 days. I mean, you were there. We froze our asses off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, well, how long am I going to stay out here?
Yeah.
We have a really short season. We initially had much longer season. When the CWD management first started, we had a much longer season. I loved it. I got to hunt with folks that, you know, that maybe had their own place to hunt, or I invited folks from the community to come in and hunt. You know, friends from different places came down and hunted. But again, a small, noisy group, and I don't know if small is the, you know, I don't know what the numbers are on that, but made that go away.
Absolutely.
So now we're back down to the 9-day season.
Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, who gave into that?
The politicians did.
But why don't the politicians understand? And they're doing it from an ignorance, from a point of ignorance. They don't understand.
Political pressure.
Political pressure.
But I've got to hope that something like this podcast gets to them.
I sure hope so, man. I mean, that's sure why we came out.
This is a terrifying
scenario. So the Wisconsin experience was really important, and the data shows that the first couple years of this aggressive management with Ernebuck was actually forcing the population down, but it was very unpopular, and so political pressure was applied, and that tool was taken out of the toolbox, thrown on the ground. Immediately, when you stop doing Ernebuck and you stopped having longer seasons, the population trends reversed and started going back up. So it was easy to label, hey, the DNR failed. Their effort to eliminate disease by having aggressive seasons failed. Like Doug said, we don't know that because we stopped. We pulled the plug on the tool. Alberta, when CWD started really blossoming in Saskatchewan, Alberta was like, we don't want it. And they found their first handful of cases right on the border between Alberta and Saskatchewan. They raised the odds a little bit. They started harvesting deer from an aerial platform called a helicopter. Okay? That helicopter with government agents sharpshooting deer to try and basically eliminate deer in a buffer zone between Saskatchewan and Alberta, knock the diseased deer out, and create a buffer zone where disease wasn't. Well, that was not very popular either.
It went over like a fart in church.
And landowners and outfitters went to the ministry and said, we can't possibly have this. And that program had every chance of being successful, and the rug was pulled out from underneath them. Okay? Years later, and the western states, you know, Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, where disease has been a long time, their wildlife health professionals have put together a set of uniform management recommendations for the western states, okay? And they're promoting the things that we've been talking about, reducing those artificial congregations of animals, implementing a harvest structure to focus on males, okay? The male-focused, the most, the social group with the highest prevalence. And also kind of what I guess I would refer to as hotspot shooting. When you see a new spark of disease out there on the landscape, get on it. Don't allow it to become established. Your only chance to be successful to eliminate disease is very, very soon before it gets established and starts, you know, spreading. So now we're seeing in Wyoming and Colorado and Montana, they're actively talking. They're talking to the media. They're talking to their commissions. And they're talking about implementing these regulatory structures, at least on an experimental basis, recognizing that doing nothing is no longer an option.
And that's one of the things that was learned from the Wisconsin experiment, for lack of a better word, that our failure, I mean, the analogy that I often use is, you know, we had this car, and it was, you know, a pretty decent car, this pretty decent model of how we were going to control the disease. But, you know, they kind of let the oil go out of the car, and they ran it in the ditch and banged it around and then brought it up and said, damn, this Ford doesn't run worth a shit. And if you can't actively try to defeat something and then say it doesn't work. You really have to let it, you know, this course. I hope that what's happening and what I can see is, you know, in the 15 years that I've learned about CWD, is that not only is there a lot being learned about the disease, but there's been a lot learned about how to manage it, both on a scientific level, but on a social level as well. And I can tell you, man, if you don't have it, you don't want it. You know, 15 years ago, I felt, and there's so much more known now than there was 15 years ago. I feel like it's not too late in Wisconsin. I mean, we can keep slowing it down, and we can protect the rest of the state, but we got a lot of work to do. And
it takes a will.
Yeah, but it really does take the
medicine's very bitter.
I think it takes information too, because I don't think people are really aware of the extent of this disease or the danger of it or all the ramifications of it.
I agree. I'm surprised in my area, intelligent people that I know that are casual hunters. Yeah, so it's getting to be deer hunting time. And you know, I'll talk to them about it. I'm like, they don't know. They don't know.
Yeah.
And that really is one of the things. So, you know, I appreciate so much the opportunity to come on here and talk about it. And Brian and Mike Samuel are going to come to Richland Center in September, which is, you know, the capital or
county seat,
I'm sorry, of Richland County. And we're going to do another presentation on chronic wasting disease, and we're advertising it widely, and more of that information has to get – education is a big part of it, Joe. You're exactly right.
Yeah, I just don't think there's enough digestible education, and I think this sort of form is one of the most digestible. All you have to do is you put it on your car, you drive around, you listen to it, you put it in your headphones when you're at the gym. You'll get this information. You'll get it in a way that you're probably not going to sit down and go through these studies.
Yeah, I appreciate it as well. I mean, I'm pretty not very savvy on social media and things like that. I wasn't even sure what a podcast was when you know, Stephen Rinella, you know, asked me to come on and do Meat Eater. And so we did that, and I understand now it's been downloaded like 650,000 times. Okay, which for a scientist, you know, I've been an author on a lot of peer-reviewed papers, and I can guarantee you they haven't been read. You take a couple zeros off of there, and that's probably the readership on those things. So from an impact, being able to get a message out to people, this type of forum really, really is helpful. And getting it down, like you say, down to a level that, you know, hunters can understand and digestible, I think is very, very important. Because we talked about how misinformation, active misinformation, to try and, you know, hey, it's not so bad, or look over here, don't look at this, look over there. You know, these diversionary tactics are very, very successful. They were very successful with tobacco. They are successful with other scientific endeavors, you know, today.
And also the simplistic perspective that, hey, look how many deer get killed by winter. You know, it's way more than CWD. Stop crying wolf.
Yeah, it's a diversionary tactic.
You know, here's the other thing that I'd like to bring up about that. I've killed some big deer. And I get it. Guys want it. People want it. Hunters want to do that.
Sure.
They want to kill.
It's what they look forward to. They look forward to hunting season. It's only one time a year.
Yeah, and you get to do that. As we're not just hunters. We're conservationists. What we do is going to affect the future. And we have an obligation to do what's best for the resource and what's best for the future. And I'll tell you this. Last year, I shot a 2.5-year-old buck opening day. And this is a nice little 8-pointer. And I celebrated that deer. I enjoyed that deer. I remember that moment just as much as the 200-inch buck that I killed. It's different. But it concerns me that at times we get so wrapped up. And I was one of them, man. I feel like a recovered alcoholic sometimes about the whole antler thing, mm-hmm. you know, like, hi, I'm Doug, and I used to be an antler.
12-step process.
Well, and there, you know, there is a part of that.
Yeah.
But remember what the joy of hunting is and the reason for it and how important it is to make sure that continues into the future. There have been some folks who really, you know, sounded huge alarms about this. And, you know, you talked about it a little bit. Yeah, 20 years from now, it might take a generation or two, but it really could become that. I want to be able to eat the meat. And I want to know that in future generations, you know, 100 years from now, when that farm is still there and it's still in the Duren name, it's been in my family for 115 years. I want to know that 100 years from now, that my descendants and their friends and their family are going to be able to come there and still enjoy that. And in order for that to happen, just like when I'm managing my oak trees, so that 100 years from now, there's going to be those big oak trees there again. 100 years from now, we have to do what we need to do now in order for this opportunity to be there for the future.
Our hunting heritage is huge. Not to mention the
financial impact.
The economics of deer hunting in a place like Wisconsin, there's over 650,000 people that hunt deer. They pump in excess of $1 billion every year into the economy of the state of Wisconsin, surrounded by hunting. If we put that on a national basis, there's millions of hunters and more billions of dollars spent. So it's not a small thing. When you think about, you know, the economics of hunting, but the heritage of hunting is very, very important. I mean, I've been hunting my whole life.
And, yeah.
You know, now I hunt primarily one county west of him. And, you know, CWD is coming. I'd say I'm sitting in my tree stand 3 years ago, and CWD is in the next county over. 2 years ago, the first CWD positive deer in Crawford County, Wisconsin, was detected less than 2 miles to the southwest of the tree that I'm sitting in. Last year, CWD had been detected in a second deer in Crawford County, this time 1 mile to the northeast of where my tree stand is. I find myself looking at deer differently. I'm looking for those subtle cues of disease, and it's changing the experience. I get calls pretty regularly from hunters who are like, you know, really, it's a coin flip out there. I'm not so sure I want to hunt there anymore.
I know because I'm on that deer advisory committee, a group of hunters came in who bought land south of us, you know, 20 miles south of us in a significant portion. And they're doing they bought it to manage it for bigger bucks. And population and all that. They came into the County Deer Advisory Committee and talked to us about what they're doing. They shot 43 deer on that property last year. All of the bucks tested, all of the antlered bucks tested positive for CWD. About 25% of the does and some of the fawns. So a doe fawn who has CWD, and she's going to be clinical and die in 2 years. She's never going to have fawns of her own. That's a population issue. But what I hope those guys are listening. What I applauded about them is what they've done is really worked with bringing in other people. And I'm going to do the same on our place, bringing in more people to hunt, to take more deer and to do what they can to manage, because they saw it. Well, they're not seeing big old bucks anymore. Because they're dead. They're dying. They're finding them, but they're finding them dead.
Yeah, we've seen that in Wyoming. You know, I mean, what, we look at the long-term impacts of disease. I talked a little bit about population impacts, driving populations down. The other thing we would identify is changes in that demographic structure. So you know, when you're hunting for the big antler deer, you're looking for animals that are 4 or 5 years old, mature or over-mature animals. In an area where CWD is established at high prevalence levels, those animals are not going to exist or will be extremely, extremely rare. They're rare now. There's an example of a real large ranch out in Wyoming. It was about 100,000 acres, and they managed historically exclusively for these over-mature mule deer, you know, the ones with the antlers, you know, like that monstrous mule deer. Even in the good times, they probably killed maybe 3 of them a year, something like that, on that vast acreage because, there's a lot of sources of mortality. They're not anymore because, those deer aren't living that long. Think about it, a math question, math quiz for Duren here.
Uh-oh.
So in this population with super high prevalence, so let's say at 18 months of age, yearling deer, let's say they have 20% prevalence, and we have that. We've demonstrated that. At 2.5, it's probably 30% prevalence. At 3.5 and 4.5 and above, it's close to 40, 45, 50% prevalence. So this is a 2-year disease, right? So half your prevalence dies every year. So if you have 20% prevalence, half of those deer are going to be dead the next year and half the year after that. Okay, so over time, you would expect these cohorts to diminish. So the math question is, in that population, how many 5-year-old bucks are there? Because disease penetrance grows over time. The answer is not many.
Yeah.
It's not
many.
Come
on, man. I'm supposed to answer the
Sound the alarm.
Yeah. And that, you know, that really is the case. And it's, again, that's why I wanted to bring Brian along, because he's going to provide the science and I'm going to try to break it down to, you know, Doug's level, and hopefully that, you know, folks can understand it. And I know I get emotional about it, but, you know, part of it is
you care.
Yeah. Well, my dad would have been 94 years old today, and he's the guy that I started deer hunting with. You know, he died a couple of years ago, and he grew up with that farm. You know, it was my great grandfather's farm, my grandfather, and that area and the Driftless area. And you've heard me talk about the Driftless area before and how important that area is to me. And this is a big, you know, part of that area. It is an emotional thing for me, which is why I then look at the science and what can we do about this. And I think about, you know, I think about Elder Leopold. Well, what would Leopold do right now? I mean, what would he be thinking about this? You know, my old man be thinking about this. You know, I know what my dad would be saying. He always thought my antler thing was bullshit. He every time he'd see a buck on the trail camera, he'd go, shoot her. he was just an old school buck hunter, man. He had an antler on it. You shot it. So all those things are in my head as I think about this. And, you know, the emotion's important. And I get the emotion part from all of these folks. And I understand that some of them want to kill big bucks. And you know, maybe because I have killed a couple of big ones, it's not as important to me. Maybe it has something to do with being 60 years old. And maybe
it's also you understand the consequences. I mean, this is a real serious issue. Forget about the ego of killing a big buck or, you know, this desire to achieve something that's more difficult than shooting a young one. There's more at stake here.
Yeah.
So you brought up an interesting thing. What would Leopold do? And, yeah, I mean, kind of a Leopold disciple, you know, father of modern wildlife ecology, started the first program of wildlife ecology at University of Wisconsin. In the 1940s, populations of deer in the northern part of Wisconsin were growing by leaps and bounds. And they were dramatically changing the landscape, you know, denuding the landscape, you know, eating the eastern white cedar. And deer in northern latitudes tend to yard together in the wintertime. And so Leopold knew that this was, you know, deleterious to the long-term viability of that ecosystem.
Unsustainable.
He took people out, landowners out, and hunters out into these deer yards in the spring to show them how there was nothing to eat within reach of a deer on its hind feet. And there were bodies of dead deer that had starved through the wintertime in order to demonstrate to them the consequences of mismanagement of deer herds. So he was a real proponent of showing people the results of doing things the wrong way and education. So I think, you know, it comes back. It's what we're trying to do. Not saying that, you know, we're Leopoldian or anything like that, but education, getting information out, getting accurate information out is maybe one of the biggest things we can do.
I think you guys did that here today. So thank you. Thank you for being here, Brian. Thank you, Doug, for organizing this.
Appreciate
and
it
putting
much.
It together. Yeah. I'm really happy we got a chance to talk and scare the shit out of me.
Thanks for the opportunity.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys. Thank you.